We closed up last session, leaving Matthew's house where he was giving a dinner in honor of Jesus before Matthew then became his full-time apostle and completely quit his tax collecting business. This dinner was interrupted by a synagogue ruler named Jairus showing up. His pleading with Jesus was on behalf of his 12-year-old daughter, who was at the point of death. And Jesus very quickly left Matthew's house to go to Jairus' house. But along the way, he was, I guess we could say, somewhat delayed by this crowd pressing around him. And a woman reaching in and grabbing hold of his covenant fringe, the little purple prominence that was to remind every Jewish person that they belonged to God's people and needed to act like that, needed to live like that. This woman was filled with the power of Jesus. And Jesus turned around and said, "Who touched me?" And Peter and the others were like, "Well, everybody's touching you. What do you mean, who touched you?" And Jesus explained, "No, I felt power go out of me. Someone touched me." And he was looking around, and the woman then finally fessed up, and Jesus told her that she should go in peace because she'd been healed by her faith. It was at that moment, remember, that Jairus's messengers from the house showed up and said, "You don't need to bother the master anymore. Your daughter is dead." And Jesus' response was, "If you'll just believe, just trust me." And so they continued to the house. And you also remember that the professional mourners were already there. They were making a big ruckus with weeping and beating their chests and having the wail of the instruments. And Jesus said, "You guys need to be quiet with all of that. She is not dead, she's sleeping," which was his way of saying that she was not permanently dead. He was going to bring her back to life momentarily. But the professional mourner's response was to make fun of Jesus because they knew for a fact the little girl was dead. And so that's where we want to pick up the story now. We're looking in Mark's Gospel, chapter number 5, verse number 40 is where we're going to begin. But we have parallels from Matthew 9 and Luke chapter 8. So Mark 5, verse 40. "They laughed at him, but he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in to where the child was." Now those who were with him, that's Peter and James and John. They are the inner circle of the apostles, and they alone are the ones that go into the bedroom area, if you will, of this residence, where the body of the child has been laid out, and probably they were in the process of washing her body and getting her wrapped up for the funeral. But now Jesus has interrupted that, and the only people in the room, mom, dad, his three apostles, and himself. Verse 41, "Taking her by the hand, he said to her, 'Talitha kumi,' which means, 'Little girl, I say to you, arise.'" This is an example given to us from time to time of the Aramaic dialect spoken by the Jews of Israel during this time period. They picked up Aramaic while they were in Babylonian exile. So most of the Jewish people in the first century were at least bilingual. They spoke Aramaic, and they also spoke the common Greek language that had been part of the coming of Alexander the Great. But some of them also do Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, which is related to Aramaic, but not exactly the same. So he says to her, "Little lamb, little girl, get up, rise up." And verse 42 says, "And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. We already knew that from another passage that we were looking at. So she gets up, and immediately, according to the Luke account, he told them, told mom and dad, get her something to eat. And mom and dad were amazed. But he told them not to tell anyone. This is Mark's Gospel, Mark 5:43. He strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Now, why does he do this? We've talked about this before, that Jesus is trying to tone down some of the overwhelming crowds that are coming to him demanding supernatural events, supernatural healings and casting out of demons. Because as he moves farther and farther into his ministry, we're getting closer and closer to the main reason why he's here, which is to become the atoning sacrifice for sin. He wants the people to be more focused on the gospel message than on the things that he can do miraculously. It's stopping him even from being able to work with his apostles. That will eventually be a reason for him leaving the Jewish areas and going to completely Gentile areas with the apostles, because he wants to spend some quality time, as we would put it, with the apostles to help them get ready for their ministry as the founding members of the church from Pentecost onward. Because while the Jewish people, because of traditional teaching, have been convinced that when the Messiah shows up, that's pretty much the end of everything. He's going to be involved in resurrecting the righteous dead, being involved in the transformation of the righteous living. The world is going to be remade. The old world will pass away. All things are going to be made new. The wicked people are going to be taken out of the way, and righteous people will be the ones in the kingdom and running things. And that's not going to happen in conjunction with Jesus' first coming. That's going to be held back until the second coming. And between those two comings is going to be the whole church era, including the gospel going out to all the Gentiles of the world. And so Jesus needs to have some quiet time with the apostles to prepare them for this new understanding of the two comings of the Messiah. And he can't do that if he's constantly being thronged by all these people demanding that he heal them. So that's why he tells them, don't tell anybody. Keep this quiet. But we are told in the Gospel of Matthew, which is where I want you to go next, Matthew 9:26, that the report of this went through all that district. Now, that's not necessarily mom and dad doing that, because remember, there was a whole bunch of people in the room, in the building, in the residence, that had seen this little girl dead. And now she's up and running around and eating and talking. So a miracle has clearly occurred, and everybody's talking about it. That's a pretty big deal. Now, as he leaves the house of Jairus, it says, Jesus passed on from there, and two blind men followed him, crying aloud, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." Now, this will sound very similar to an event later in the ministry of Jesus when he's at Jericho, and there will be a couple of blind men saying pretty much these same words. This one's happening up in Capernaum area in Galilee. So these two blind men are begging for Jesus to have mercy on him, They consider him to be a fulfillment of scripture passages. He's the son of David, meaning the Messiah. Verse 28, when he entered the next house, which is probably, excuse me, in my opinion, the house of Peter, because we know it's in the same area as the house of Matthew. So when he entered the house, the blind men came to him, probably escorted into his presence. And Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" So do you have faith? Do you have confidence? Do you trust me that I can give you your sight? And they said to him, "Yes, Lord." And then he touched their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, be it done to you." Excuse me. So once again, Jesus, out of compassion, does a miracle. But notice he does it privately, inside the building, away from the crowd. And then what does he do next? Verse 30. Their eyes were opened, and Jesus sternly warned them, "See that no one knows about it." So he tells these two guys, again, same thing that he told mom and dad a while ago. Don't tell everybody that I did this for you. But they went away, spread his fame throughout all that district. So they still can't contain themselves. And we can appreciate that. We can understand that. They should have been obedient to the command of Jesus, but they feel so overwhelmed with this miracle that they have to share it, they think. And so they do it in direct opposition to his command. Now, I want to correct something that I've heard some people try to suggest in these miracles where Jesus tells people not to talk about it. This is not Jesus using reverse psychology. You know, we have that phrase today where you tell somebody don't do it because you really want them to do it. You really want them to talk about it. That is not the case. Jesus does definitely mean it when he says, don't talk about this stuff. Keep it private. And the reason is, as I already expressed in relation to the raising from the dead of the little girl, is that Jesus is so mobbed by all these crowds demanding he do miracles for them that he's not able to spend the quality time in teaching his apostles, his inner group of disciples, what they're going to need to know in order to function at the beginning of the church era. And that is problematic. He will end up going to non-Jewish areas to get a lot of this later training done. And even on the night that he goes to the upper room and has those last words with the disciples before he goes to the cross the next day, he is expressing that he hasn't been able to teach them everything yet, and that the Holy Spirit was going to help them come up to the full knowledge base that they were going to need in order to do the work as foundational members in the church. Now, we're still not done. Verse number 32 of Matthew 9. As they were going away, that is the two recently healed blind men, behold, a demon-oppressed man who was mute was brought to him. Now, again, this sounds similar to another event that happened yesterday on our timeline, on the day that the Sermon on the Mount was taking place. And that was the healing of a mute, demon-possessed man that prompted the Pharisees to accuse Jesus of healing by the power of Satan. This is a separate event. And so when this demon had been cast out, the mute man spoke, and the crowds marveled, saying, "Never was anything like this seen in Israel." Now, they're not talking about this specific miracle only, but just all this stuff together. This has been a very busy period of time, just a few days that we're looking at with the Sermon on the Mount and the sermon in the parables and all of the ministry that's taking place at or near Capernaum. These folks are confessing out loud, we've never, ever seen anything like what Jesus is doing right now in our presence. And so they are anticipating he's got to be the Messiah. But in opposition to that, we've got all these Pharisees that don't want that belief to get a hold of the people. And so they are going to repeat their accusation from the day before. The Pharisees said, he casts out demons by the prince of demons. So their explanation is, it's an inside job. Now, Jesus has already responded to this. Matthew recorded it, like Mark and Luke did, that you can't have Satan fighting against Satan and his kingdom to remain intact. You can't have this casting out of demons in such large numbers with such powerful authority as Jesus is doing, and it be fake, because it does too much damage to the demonic power base that these demons are part of. At this point in our chronology, it would appear that Jesus takes his 12 apostles and heads off on another little tour around Galilee. And this is where Mark's Gospel, chapter number 6, picks up the story about Jesus going back to Nazareth. Now, he's been to Nazareth earlier, and it was problematic because the people wanted, well, first, they were really impressed with him being a hometown boy done well. But then he ends up criticizing the Jewish people as a whole for not having enough faith to be used by God, and that in ages past, God has preferred the faith of Gentiles over the lack of faith of Jewish people. And they almost stone Jesus to death over that little conversation. So here we are going back there again. This is what it says, Mark chapter 6, verse 1. He went away from there, and so that's a reference to where we were at in the Capernaum area at Jairus' house. So he went away from there and came to his hometown. That is the town of his childhood, which would be Nazareth, and it's 20-some miles by road from Capernaum, so about a day's walk easily. His disciples followed him, and on the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue. Not surprising again, he is a well-known rabbi, and when a rabbi comes to a local synagogue, he is often invited to comment on the scripture passage for that day's reading. So Jesus is, as we would say, the guest speaker at the Nazareth synagogue. Now, the leadership might have had a little bit of hesitation of letting him do this guest commentary, because of past events, but he does it anyway. And so many who heard him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? What's the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Now, again, this is kind of an overall response to Jesus' teaching. He teaches not like the scribes and the Pharisees. He doesn't do that chain method where he says, we have a rabbi who told who said that his rabbi said that his rabbi said that his rabbi said that this is how this passage should be understood. So they're always appealing to a chain of rabbis into the past. Jesus doesn't do that. He just simply says, this is what the text says, this is what it means, and this is how you should respond. And Jesus is also doing miracles. Everybody's aware of that. He's probably being mobbed here, at least on the road, heading to Nazareth. Verse number 3, is not this the carpenter, the technon, the woodworker, the construction guy, the son of Mary? Joseph is not mentioned here, and I've shared with you before, I am of the belief that Joseph must have very recently passed from life as Jesus began his ministry. So Joseph is a recent memory, but he's a fading memory of this family. So is this not the carpenter? Because Jesus worked as a carpenter probably from his early teen years, maybe 11, 12, 13, somewhere in that neighborhood, he started apprenticing as a carpenter with Joseph. And he kept on doing it right up until he left Nazareth to go to the lower Jordan Valley to be immersed by John at the beginning of his ministry. So Jesus was a carpenter for a good 2 decades here at Nazareth. So is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James, or proper name is Jacob here, and Joses, that's Joseph Jr. basically, and Judas. Judas is the guy that wrote the book Jude in our New Testament. James is the guy that wrote the book James in the New Testament. And then Shimon or Simon, so 4 named brothers that Jesus has. And are not his sisters here with us? So Jesus had at least 2 sisters, possibly more. So between Jesus and these named brothers and the sister possibilities, there were at least 6 siblings that Jesus had, at least. And so Jesus is being thought of in those terms. This is just the hometown boy that's now grown up. And so it says, and they took offense at him. I'm going to substitute a phrase that we're using quite a bit nowadays, and that is trigger. Because the word that appears here in the text for offense is the idea of the little trigger on a trap. Like on a mouse trap, for example, that little place that you put the bait, that's the trigger of the trap. And so the Jewish people in this time period, the Gentile people, all speaking Greek, use this idea of the trigger on a trap is what causes you trouble. So they took offense at him. They were triggered by him. They can't believe that somebody from their town that they watched grow up, that they know his family, and his family apparently doesn't believe in him yet, he was a carpenter for a good 2 decades. How can he be the Messiah? See, they've reevaluated their original thinking about the hometown boy done good. Now they're thinking, probably because of the Pharisees' reaction, he seems to not be the Messiah. How could he be? He's just a person from Nazareth, just a carpenter from Nazareth. So they're being triggered by Jesus. Verse number 4, Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown, and among his relatives, and in his own household. Jesus has said this before, same context. When you grow up somewhere, it's hard for the people there to think of you as anything but the little kid that was here. When I have gone back to my hometown in southern Missouri and preached there, I still know that several of the people that I grew up under can't take me as seriously as they would somebody else in the same circumstances, because they would be able to say things to me like, I remember babysitting you, or I remember you, I remember having to change your diapers, or I remember when you did this little naughty thing over here and I had to discipline you. So they have a hard time taking a hometown boy seriously when he's in a serious situation. So that's what Jesus is testifying to here. Now, that all helps us understand verse number 5. Are you ready? And he could do no mighty work there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. Now, some people get hung up on this idea. What do you mean Jesus couldn't do miracles? It's not that he didn't have the capability of doing miracles. It was these guys are not even bothering to come and ask him for assistance. A lot of the Nazarene people of Nazareth, have written him off. So while he is getting a lot of non-Nazareth people show up, and he can heal a few of them, the majority are not even bothering to come now. And so Jesus is surprised. He is shocked that he's been written off by this town where he grew up and where he worked as a carpenter early on. And then Mark chapter 6, verse 6 finishes by saying, and he went about among the villages teaching. So he leaves Nazareth and continues traveling around with his apostles.